Our case this afternoon is 151335, AstraZeneca v. Breath Limited. Mr. Sipes.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Christopher Sipes on behalf of AstraZeneca, plaintiff in the matter below. Your Honor, we believe this is a somewhat unusual case. This is a case in which the desirability of the claimed product was well known and well established. And the challenge in the claimed invention was achieving it, was being able to make it. And what we have here is extraordinary evidence, objective indicia, that the product could not be achieved in the prior art. We have, for example, a long record of failure by AstraZeneca and by others. We have an acknowledgement by defendant's own expert about why it was that there was so much failure. She said...
Okay, well, let me just stop you there, because what's one might say is extraordinary about this case, and I assume you've been on the other side of this, where a district court does 165 pages of fact-finding, goes through the testimony of perhaps not all of the 29 witnesses, but a large number of those witnesses. So tell us where. I mean, tell us what was wrong with what she did, because I mean, most of it is a deferential standard of review, and she did enormously detailed fact-finding on most of the areas you're touching on, right?
Yes, Your Honor. No, this court has held, and it's correct, that the way in which objective considerations are evaluated can be reviewed de novo as a matter of law. For example, the Allergan v. Apotex case. There were two issues here that were sort of controlling legal issues. And we believe, with all due respect to the district court and with some inducement from defendants, she got them both wrong. The first had to do with whether or not the objective indicia, the record, for example, of commercial success, of long-felt need, and candidly of failure, was negated because it was being driven by FDA and regulatory requirements to enter the market at all, rather than the explicit consumer demand.
Well, maybe so. That's one way of looking at it, perhaps. But it's not, one could argue, but it's not so much that she negated it. It's just she said that if that's not the be-all and end-all, that can't possibly be, you know, the FDA requirement can't govern it, or everything, every commercial success that derives from an FDA approval would automatically give you enough to upset an obviousness prima facie determination. So what did she actually do about the FDA?
So for example, here are some of her statements to make it clear how she handled it. At A139, in discussing long-felt need, It is true, as AZ has claimed, that a sterile product may have been preferred based on health risks. Yet the evidence conclusively demonstrates that had the FDA determined that Pulmicort Respules could be sold in the U.S. without being sterile, the unmet need would have been met. So she therefore discounted the long-felt need and the fact that Pulmicort was the first product to meet that need. That was a legal error. The fact that
the long-felt need being the felt need for sterility?
The felt need.
The long-felt need for the product which, per the FDA, had to be sterile.
What was needed, the long-felt need, was for an FDA-approved nebulized corticosteroid. To be FDA-approved, to be available in the market, it had to be sterile. And there was agreement by both plaintiff and defendant's experts that FDA's push for sterility dated back to the 1980s. And you'll notice, for example, on page A31, in her opinion, she cites to a Lockman reference from 1986 as describing the benefits of sterility. So the need for nebulized corticosteroids would, in order to come on the market as an FDA-approved product.
When you say nebulized, but nebulized is not one of the claim limitations, right?
That is correct.
So in terms of the claim limitations, where is the long-felt need for a sterile product, which I take it really is the only thing that was different about this product?
To be a nebulized corticosteroid is an inhaled suspension.
I understand, but that wasn't what the claims required,
correct.
Right?
To be a nebulized corticosteroid would require it to be pharmaceutically acceptable, highly pure, and sterile. That is what the claim is drawn to.
Right, if the claim were drawn to nebulized steroids, but it's not. So where's the long-felt need per the claim?
The long-felt need would have been in the pharmaceutical industry in order to meet the desire for an inhaled corticosteroid suspension, a nebulized corticosteroid, one would have to develop a pharmaceutically acceptable, highly pure, sterile, micronized corticosteroid suspension. That is what a nebulized corticosteroid suspension is highly pure, pharmaceutically acceptable, and sterile. The issues, and their own expert admitted this, the issue with achieving that was among the rate limiting step was sterility. So the claim limits are drawn specifically to the challenge in the art, and the what is claimed is precisely what was needed. In order to provide nebulized therapy to young children, one would need a micronized corticosteroid suspension.
Well, but you're not saying that that's what actually drove demand. You're saying that because you couldn't have gotten the product in the market here in the U.S. without it, it inferentially drove demand? Is that your theory?
More than that, Your Honor. Both the success of the product and the long-felt need resulted from meeting FDA requirements. That has been the limiting step of entering the market in the U.S. to provide...
So that's what you want us to say as a matter of law, if one of the steps of the claim are what was necessary to assure or to secure FDA approval, then by definition it's satisfying unmet needs and commercial success?
No, Your Honor, this is slightly different than that. This is a case in which the FDA requirement, sterility, is an element of the claim, is the element of the claim that their own expert admitted is the rate-limiting step to achieving success. This is not, for example, if one has a formulation patent and one comes in the market and achieves success, well, FDA doesn't require specific formulations, specific excipients. There's no nexus necessarily in that way. This is different. This is a case in which the barrier and the express requirement is exactly what was in the claims. It had to be sterile, highly pure, and pharmaceutically acceptable. Those three things at the same time. That's what's claimed. That was the rate-limiting step. That's what was needed in order to obtain an FDA-approved product. So there was a long-felt need for that highly pure, pharmaceutically acceptable, sterile suspension.
Well, now, the FDA actually didn't impose the requirement of sterility, I take it, with specific reference to this product until pretty shortly before you came up with the sterile product, right?
And we think that further illustrates our point. So FDA was pushing for sterility from well before, but the problem was it did not appear achievable with suspensions. There are many technical difficulties, and the FDA recognized those difficulties in making a suspension.
It was not achievable, but yet, don't you really mean it was not easily achievable on a commercial scale, large scale, because certainly it was achievable on a smaller scale, laboratory scale.
I don't believe that's correct, and I don't believe the record shows any laboratory trials which succeeded either. To the contrary, AstraZeneca's own efforts, which would have included the research efforts by some of the scientists here, failed with everything. O'Neill, in the O'Neill patent, there's an effort to make it through sterile filtration. That failed for O'Neill. There is no record of success with any of the methods in the past, regardless of scale.
What about the Bratsford patents? What do you say is missing from the Bratsford patents? Is that just the question of purity as opposed to sterility? Because that was a pharmaceutical composition of a suspension, if I recall correctly, which was sterile.
The Bratsford patent was the 76. It's the one of the early composition patents. And what was described there was a research effort that shows a suspension for injection. There's no indication that it was sterile, although injections on a commercial scale would be sterile. We don't know what was it. In other words, it doesn't expressly say sterile. It's a research effort. There's no indication that that example was on the market as a sterile product. We don't know what the purity was. We don't even know if it was pharmaceutically acceptable. If you look at that patent, the entire disclosure is simply a reference to a steroid suspension for injection. We don't know how, if it was sterilized, how it was sterile, what the purity was. And remember, one of the issues here is take moist heat. The evidence is very clear that Moissy degrades budesonide. In fact, defendants themselves, Breath in its patent referenced using standard moist heat, and there was too much degradation, degradation that would move it outside the claim limits of our patent. For all we know, there was moist heat because degradation isn't, there isn't even a reference to purity. We don't know what was done in that patent, but we do know that it doesn't disclose any purity level, whether it was pharmaceutically acceptable. It doesn't even reference sterility. But if it was sterilized, for example, with moist heat, that might be fine for research perspectives, but it doesn't overcome the challenge here, which is to be highly pure, sterile, and pharmaceutically acceptable. And moist heat is a very standard sterilization technique, but the O'Neill of moist heat, the standard autoclaving, doesn't work. And that's not just me saying that. That's what Breath Watson said in their patent. They tried it. They experimented with moist heat, and they concluded moist heat created too much degradation. So what we have here is a situation where we actually have evidence of what happened with each of these prior art methods, and each one failed. And in fact, we as an AstraZeneca came into FDA and reviewed that with FDA, not just looking forward to what we would do, but what we had done.
Preferred. So that's the right pronunciation.
I believe it's Preferred, but it was okay. it's a Scandinavian product that I don't want to So Preferred was in the early 80s, and it was made. It's very clear that it was made through. It was there was an ethylene oxide process applied to that, and that was actually in the prosecution history. And there was evidence of...
So it was sterile.
Well, that's it's not clear. It was labeled sterile at that time, and this is set forth...
It's your product, and your company is made, is calling it sterile. That's a pretty good indication that at least you believe it's sterile then.
Well, yes, and then what happened is two concerns were raised. One was the residues, and the other was, can the ethylene oxide penetrate to kill microorganisms inside the powder?
Now, that's a very factual question, and Judge Bum found with respect to both of those that those were solvable problems under the prior art, right?
Well, with all due respect to Judge Bum, I believe what she found is there was a reasonable expectation of success.
Right.
That's not the same as saying actual success. We think that there are two requirements to be shown, and this is standard law. You need to show both a motivation to combine to achieve the claimed invention and a reasonable expectation of success. We think the court, and at the defendant's urging, erroneously overlooked the first element and looked only at reasonable expectation without actually asking the first question, which is, does it achieve success? And there is no evidence...
Tell me again, you're saying that the motivation to combine requires a showing that you actually you could achieve success with absolute certainty?
What it requires is showing that the combination achieves the claimed invention. The test is that a POSA would have been motivated to combine the teachings of the prior art references to achieve the claimed invention. It is defendant's burden to show that the combination, for example, O'Neill, moist heat, and budesonide, achieves the claimed invention. You
but
can't
we know that moist heat is a workable solution to the problem because that's why we're here. Moist heat or sterile filtration, right?
Your Honor, actually, no. The testing on the prior art moist heat showed that there was degradation and you didn't meet the 98.5.
But a moist heat methodology did achieve the invention.
But
That's why we have an infringement action.
That's right, but that moist heat process is not the prior art moist heat. For example, Apotex...
Well, if it had been the prior art moist heat, of course we'd have anticipation. But the question is, does the combination of the prior art directions towards using moist heat plus the skill of a person of ordinary skill in the art yield a successful process? And we do know that there was a successful process. Therefore, that... Part of your argument, it seems to me, at least with respect to moist heat and sterile filtration, goes away.
Your Honor, with all due respect, if the moist heat that the defendant was using was the prior art, that would be obvious because the prior art does not teach applying moist heat to budesonide. But in that case, they acknowledge, or I think they've admitted in their ANDAs, that it's not. For example, Apotex specifically referred to They are moistening processes innovative. That's A8694. And if you look at it, it's lower temperature. It's shorter period of time. It's much less water. Actually, we think, generally, it looks more like the low dry heat that we discovered. But it doesn't matter. None of the defendants put on evidence to say the moist heat process they're doing is the prior art. It's not O'Neill, which is the combination they urged. O'Neill, we know, failed. This is what the district court said at A84. She acknowledged, for example, that Brett's own McCaffer patent suggests that moist heat sterilization causes unacceptable degradation, but she said she rejected this evidence because it has no persuasive value as the question is what was known prior to 1997. That's at A84. And again, A85. There is no evidence prior to 97 warning a POSA that budesonide will unacceptably degrade. So we think that's there, but the key point, Your Honor, is the discounting of the failures of the long-felt need and the commercial success, because that requirement of sterility, which is in the claim, the ability to achieve sterile, highly pure pharmaceuticals, which is in the claim, came about through pressure from FDA and was a barrier to getting on the market. And we think that was a legal error to discount the objective considerations on the basis that they were coming from the regulatory agency.
Okay, you're a minute over. We'll restore 2 minutes of your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
We'll try to even it out. So you're all set on dividing time?
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
William Ricozzi on behalf of Watson and Brett. The court should affirm the judgment of the district court. Astor got the broad construction it wanted, and now it doesn't want to live with the prior art consequences that are set forth, as Your Honor mentioned, in very detailed fact findings that are based on admissions of Astra, credibility determinations.
What about the main argument that your friend seems to make about the commercial success and long-term need with regard to her discounting or not, I don't know how much emphasis they would rely on, the FDA approval?
2 points.
If they couldn't put it on the market here without the sterility component, so isn't that it? So they get achieve sterility and it's on the market, case closed. There's your nexus, right?
We disagree, Your Honor. 2 points to that. Number one, she did not discount FDA approval. She just refused to stop there. She took the extra step and actually delved into what is satisfying that need, what is the need, what's satisfying it, what's driving the success.
They could not have gotten on the market without meeting the sterility component, right?
Well, as of right now, in the record, the FDA said we expect it to be sterile because everything else is sterile. So there's no skepticism there either. But back to Your Honor's commercial success in need point, the district court didn't refuse to consider it. She just refused to apply a legal rule that FDA approval requirements automatically satisfy nexus and commercial success.
The Chief Judge's question. I mean, suppose that the FDA had imposed this requirement 10 years early. Everything else is the same. And it took 10 years for somebody to come up with a sterilization protocol that would satisfy the FDA. Would you agree that that constitutes long-felt unmet need?
Everybody wants
in the market. It's a highly valuable asset to have. Everybody wants in, and only AstraZeneca comes up with long-felt need.
Well, but if it's commensurate in scope with the claims, as Your Honor mentioned during the earlier argument, so here it's just a broad powder and suspension claim. If, for example, no one was able to make a sterile steroid suspension for a decade, then that could weigh in favor of the analysis. But that was the point I wanted to mention, Your Honor. There had been sterile steroids for 50 years prior to this invention. Dozens of them had been sterilized, and in fact, using the ETO method that you just heard disparaged yet again, ophthalmic steroids, things that you put in your eye, had been successfully sterilized.
ETO, you mean
ethylene oxide? I'm sorry. Dropping down into the acronym.
Ethylene oxide, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Ethylene oxide.
It's called EO in the briefs. So
yes, I apologize. EO had been used for 5 decades before this invention, and in fact, even in the 1990s, and today, it's continually being used to make sterile steroid suspensions, number one. Number two, Prefarid was in fact successfully sterilized.
Well, I guess none of you used that system, right?
We did not, but the defendants used other prior art methods.
Right, but that's not one of them that has been used commercially.
Not on budesonide, except in 1980 it was used commercially with budesonide. In 1994, the mid-90s, ethylene oxide was used commercially with other sterile steroids. So to follow up on Your Honor's hypothetical, we don't have that here. We have in the art dozens and dozens of successes of sterile steroids using all kinds of methods, EO, irradiation for Preparid and other sterile steroids. The defendants all succeeded. That is undisputed in this record. I think it's very telling that no one that actually tried to make a sterile budesonide and get FDA approval ever failed. Each defendant succeeded, and they did it with prior art methods, for example, like sterile filtration, the oldest of all of them. Their own expert, Dr. Williams, admitted that Watson Supplier uses a method that is identical to that found in the prior art, all the standard methods found in that 1994 FDA guide. He described it as a very old method and one that's been long known in the art. Other parties succeeded with prior art methods. So we don't have those failures of others in the art. We don't have skepticism on FDA's part because they expected it to be sterile. They said it better be. It would be unprecedented not to have one. And that's perfectly consistent with the way...
Although they added that if you can't do it, we'll give you a pass.
They did. They said if you...
And that seems to be, it indicates at least that the FDA was agnostic as to the prospects of sterilization.
I think the record shows they weren't agnostic because even their own witness, Mr. Mathers, testified that FDA wasn't skeptical and that they thought, in fact, it was possible. And if you look at the way the art had advanced by that...
Doubt, in any event, it, presumably in the FDA's mind. Otherwise, why would they have said, if you can show that it was impossible, we'll back off?
I would classify it according to the record, Your Honor, that they acknowledged the difficulties of a suspension. But we have to look at that in context and not in a vacuum when FDA is looking and seeing that no one has ever failed to make a sterile steroid suspension. Everyone had succeeded up until that point. And FDA didn't even know about Preferid where Astra had succeeded back in 1980. And again, the fact findings have not been challenged. And I think that's very important here that you don't even see the words clear air in their papers except in footnotes. And this court's made clear over and over that that's a waiver of the right to even challenge those facts. Now, to get to the Chief Judge Prost's point again, my second point on the commercial success analysis is this court's case law says you want to look at objective indicia to avoid the hindsight trap. And that's very important for the court to look at it. But here, if we look at this record, there is no possibility of hindsight. When there are admissions by all of their experts in the record that everyone wanted to sterilize budesonide, number one. Number two, admissions that you would have a strong motivation to use the conventional sterilization methods, again admitted. And then for two of the methods, sterile filtration and moist heat, their own experts, Dr. Williams and Dr. Akers, admitted the skilled person would have a reasonable expectation of success in creating and achieving the sterile product using those methods. So we don't have that same issue of we need these secondary considerations to avoid hindsight. There is no hindsight. Motivation to combine, to achieve all of the art combinations, all admitted here. And there is no actual success standard. They want to manufacture a legal error saying that somehow the judge failed to require actual success in the art. Well, we believe there was actual success in the art with Preferid and Bratson in the dozens of sterile steroids. The fact of the matter, the standard is reasonable expectation of success to achieve that claimed sterile product. And again, we have fact-finding after fact-finding on not just one method, but four methods. And this is a product claim. So we only have to show any way to make it. The district court found there are at least four ways to make it successfully to the skilled person's eyes or any combination thereof. So we believe there was well more than enough here and not even an attempt to show clearly erroneous. And again, my last comment, Your Honor, we have to be careful with this commercial success and FDA approval requirement issue. And I would point, I believe it's the Cow case, that Judge Lynn, where you were dealing, or the court was dealing with secondary considerations, commercial success, and need, and dealing with evidence that was coming in on an approved FDA product, Opana ER, that embodied the claims. Now, the court looked at that and didn't stop with FDA approval upon ER and sales. The court went a step further and said, we really need to see, though, what's actually driving that success. We're not going to stop there. And in that case, what would have had to go differently if FDA approval was the end-all, be-all. Now, we acknowledge FDA approval, the court looked at it, but you can't stop there. You have to drop down and see what was the claimed feature that's not in the prior art driving success, and there's no contest here. Sterility was not driving success. Physicians don't prescribe this drug because of sterility, and the need identified by their own expert, Dr. Vervarelli, wasn't for a sterile product. It was just for a nebulized product. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, we have a perfect test case that we know sterility is not responsible for success or satisfying need because non-sterile budesonide was fabulously successful overseas. It was prescribed by their own expert to her own patients. It was used in the U.S. clinical trials. So sterility had nothing to do with what was going on here in driving or satisfying need. And with that, Your Honor, I believe I don't want to cut into all my colleagues' time.
Actually, you've still got 2 minutes on your clock. We've been running them individually. 1 minute.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor.
Feel free to sit down.
I can take a hint, Your Honor. Unless there's any other questions, I will yield my time to my colleagues. Thank you. May it please the Court. Taras Gracie of Steptoe & Johnson on behalf of Sandoz. I wanted to talk specifically about the moist heat sterilization process, and with specific regard to O'Neill. That's a patent that issued in 1976, and what O'Neill teaches is O'Neill teaches a method of using the conventional moist heat sterilization process, but it saturates it with a sodium chloride solution. And what O'Neill then states is after step A, which is the first step where the moist heat sterilization is used, or they call it autoclaving or steam sterilization, it's all the same. It said that analytical studies, including infrared analysis, indicated intact dexamethasone acetate with no decomposition, even after autoclaving the steroid sodium chloride mixture in step A for 1 hour at 121 C. Now that's very important because what we heard from AstraZeneca's counsel is, well, there's other art that says that O'Neill doesn't work. Well, that's not correct, or that it results in impurities. O'Neill itself says that there are no degradation, that there's no decomposition. But how does AstraZeneca back up its statement? They look at two post-art patents. We have to keep in mind the critical date is in 1997, and O'Neill was in 1976, so 21 years before the critical date. They look to Bernini, the Bernini patent, and they look to McCaffer, both of which use steroids, it's true, but both just said they simply used the standard moist heat sterilization process known in the art. That's not O'Neill. O'Neill autoclaves at 121C for 20 to 30 minutes, but it's autoclaving a steroid solution that's been saturated with sodium chloride, and that's critical. That's what the district court stated when it evaluated defendant's expert, Ms. Moldenhauer, and found her testimony to be convincing. Dr. Williams himself admitted to me that if he was a POSA in 1997 looking at the prior art and he read O'Neill, he would swap in budesonide and you'd have a reasonable expectation of success. That's the plaintiff's own expert who said that. And with regard to, again, Bernini and McCaffer, all they say is they use the wet steam process under conditions similar. And I think what they're trying to do is create some kind of operability argument, or perhaps say the prior art is not enabling. That's a heavy burden for them to meet. Prior art is presumed to be enabled. And yet, did the district court analyze this? Yes, they did. And what Judge Baum said throughout her 166-page opinion was that, A, she didn't find the AstraZeneca's witnesses credible, other than Dr. Williams on this point, but B, this is just a vague statement about similar conditions, not the precise conditions. And neither McCaffer nor Bernini actually go through what is in step A of O'Neill and then come to the conclusion that, well, if we moist heat sterilize, we end up with some degradation.
Are you going to talk about sterile filtration, or is your colleague going to talk about that, or is...
I could yield back some time to Mr. Ricozzi because that was more his issue, but...
Okay, well, that's all right.
But, I mean, I can...
And if you want to give it a shot, you can tell me what you want to say about it, and if you don't want to say anything about it, that's...
Sure, right. I'm happy to say... Well, here's what I'll say about it. First of all, you know, sterile filtration was known and set forth. It's been a long-used process, was set forth in the 1994 guidelines. Then we can look to Harris. Now, Judge Baum decided, looked at the issue.
She thought Harris was not prior art.
She did, and that's exactly what I was going to say. Now, we disputed that, but we don't even need to dispute it because there's no doubt that it's contemporaneous art. And contemporaneous art, as this court has held, can be used to show the level of ordinary skill in the art. So you look to Harris, and that's great, but you don't even have to get there. You can look at the 1994 inspection guide. And this is clearly... Oh, I can't tell. It's my time.
You're over, but that's okay. Okay. You've got your
time. I don't want to get into Mr. Bates' time. So I'll just finish with this. That Judge Baum looked at Dr. Aker's testimony, which is from AstraZeneca, and Mr. Zacchaeo, and found that there was no doubt that one could have a reasonable expectation of success using filter sterilization. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Richard Basil for Apotex. I just want to reemphasize a point that was made by Mr. Ocozie, that the defendants have produced an overwhelming amount of evidence to establish that there was a reasonable expectation of success in creating the claimed product. It's undisputed that the court recognized that there were five well-known sterilization methods, and these were analogous to the tools in a workman's toolbox. If one of ordinary skill in the art had a job to do and they had tools in their toolbox, obviously a person skilling out with five tools in the toolbox would believe they had a greater likelihood of success than the worker with just one tool in that toolbox. So having the question here on obviousness was, a worker having all five of those sterilization methods in their toolbox, would they have had a reasonable expectation of success? Now, what the defendant showed at trial was that four of those tools, all on their own, they're the only tool in the toolbox, they would created a reasonable expectation of success in creating the product.
What would you say is to Mr. Sykes' point, and now focusing just on the two methods that are not employed, as I understand it, by any of the defendants at least, what do you say to his point that it has not been shown that either the EO or irradiation actually work to achieve the invention?
Well, first,
may have been a reasonable expectation, but that expectation is presumably defeated by the fact that you don't have any example of somebody that's actually using those methods.
Well, first of all, the ethylene oxide is absolutely shown to work in their preferred product. For some reason.
Well, but let's assume right now. We've really got anticipation.
No, we don't, because it was a foreign use, Your Honor. I think under the present law, we might have. But the problem was we didn't.
You're right. It is a foreign use. But in any event, let's assume preferred away for the moment. What I'm trying to get at is it the case that reasonable expectation is not enough if, in fact, there isn't a demonstration of, in fact, achievement of the invention?
No, well, I think the law is pretty clear on we're making obviousness arguments.
Well, I understand.
We don't have to show absolute predictability, and if we have
predictability, but do you have to show achievement? In other words, normally that's not a problem because there's no issue that something was achieved because you have an infringement action. The person who is accused of infringement achieved it. But that's not necessarily true when you have four different methods, only two of which are being actually used and two of which are not. So my question is, don't you have to show that, in fact, irradiation actually works and there's evidence that it actually works as opposed to there merely being a reasonable expectation that it will work?
Well, I think that's... first of all, I have a hard time if the test is reasonable expectation.
Right. Reasonable,
that presumes you don't have to... Then, but you're asking me to say reasonable expectation equals knowing it will work.
There are many instances in which there is a reasonable expectation that something will work, which is defeated by reality. It turns out it doesn't work. You're not arguing, I take it, that all you need is a reasonable expectation that it will work, even if in fact it is shown conclusively that it doesn't work.
If there's conclusive evidence it won't work,
right,
that's correct. But I think during trial, we heard a whole litany of experts came up to talk about these five known sterilization methods. They're in the USP, they govern all the pharmaceutical industry, and those of skill in the art know they can use them and have used them successfully in other products. You know, for example, ethylene oxide, you know, one of the things AstraZeneca keeps arguing, when you push them on the nebulization, that's not part of the claim. Your argument starts to morph that the FDA was skeptical about being able to make a sterile glucocorticoid steroid suspension. And that's in their brief. They actually say that. They don't say nebulized. They just say a sterile glucocorticoid steroid suspension, and that no one had ever done it before.
And that's just patent, that's demonstrably false. Their own expert, Dr. Zinnell, listed 7 different corticosteroids in commercial ophthalmic products, 16 different products, sterile, pharmaceutically acceptable, on the market, beginning in the 1950s all the way to the 1990s. 50 years, people have been sterilizing and making product. So to say these sterilization methods wouldn't work on these products, it's just not true, because there's actual products on the market that are being sterilized, sterile corticosteroid suspensions.
But not budesonide.
But not, well, budesonide had been sterile. You struck upon it. Bratzen, it showed it was sterile. There's no evidence in the record.
But Bratzen doesn't fully anticipate.
Well, because there's no purity in Bratzen. Right. The testimony, it's sterile.
Everyone's missing one.
Well, that's why obviousness was born, Your Honor. I think if everything was 102, I think when we were back in 2012, I was worried about rhodocretin patent with the liposomes, and I had everything but one element, and you sent us back. So we're trying to get it right this time, and I think we did, because all those elements are there in the prior art. Bratzen is a sterile corticosteroid. It's for injection. All the people agreed. All the experts agreed. They would have known it was sterile.
When you say Bratzen is sterile, you're inferring sterility from the fact that it's injection?
Yes, because all our experts recognize you would never inject it. These were used in tests on humans. You would never inject a human with something that wasn't sterile.
Okay.
So the presumption of those with skill in the art reading that would have presumed that it was sterile. So I have things.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. We'll give you 4 minutes for rebuttal just to keep things even.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start with what Mr. Roccozzi mentions, that we have test case here. We do have test case here. He points to Europe as a test case. Europe is a great test case. In Europe, there are several different kinds of nebulized corticosteroids in the market. All of them are highly pure, pharmaceutically acceptable corticosteroid suspensions. Only one of them has come into the U.S., and that's Pulmicort Respules. And the reason for that, we know too, and that is because of sterility. So we know from the European test case that sterility is the challenge, that achieving sterility while maintaining high purity and maintaining pharmaceutical acceptability in a micronized corticosteroid suspension is extremely difficult. That's telling facts. We have
That was the challenge that you needed to meet to get FDA approval.
To come into the United States and sell in the United States. That's absolutely correct.
It's a different question, is it not, from whether that was what was causing the commercial success or relating to the long-felt need and all of these other issues we've been talking about?
Well, we do know that the law says there's a presumption of nexus if it's an embodiment of claims, which we have here, and the burden shifts to defendants to show by clear and convincing evidence that the subject matter of invention did not contribute to the success of the product. That's the Echo Lochem case at 227 F3rd 1378, cyclobenzaprine at 1078 in Note 5. Certainly, achieving FDA approval is an important component of commercial success. It's hard to believe it didn't, but there's another element too. Wherever you are in the world, you rely on the regulatory agency as the consumer to assure safety. And so, in some sense, FDA is the gatekeeper here. It is, without achieving FDA success, one has no success. And after all, as a matter of logic, the fact that sterility was viewed as so important in the U.S. shouldn't negate the importance of the injective indicia. And certainly, the artisans in the field are working with an eye to what FDA wants.
What about sterile filtration? Why is it not the case, particularly in light of the admissions by one of the doctors, Akers, and I guess it's Dr. Williams, why is it not the case that that was a known, reliable means of sterilization, but it just was burdensome, expensive, cumbersome, and was not commercially possible?
We believe...
Which doesn't get you.
We believe that here is where hindsight is most dangerous. There is no denying that all of these methods, including filter sterilization, were known. Filter sterilization followed by aseptic processing. Right. But this we know too. First of all, we know that AstraZeneca tried it and failed at the time. More strikingly, they referred to the 94 FDA guidance. That never mentions corticosteroids. There is not a single piece of prior art that reports successful sterile filtration and aseptic processing of any corticosteroid. In fact, O'Neill, on which they rely, reports failure.
What do you do with the admissions, though, by Dr. Akers and Dr. Williams, where they basically said, that system, we would expect that would work?
I believe what Dr. Akers said and what the testimony shows is that is a sterile filtration and aseptic processing, if it could be done perfectly, would achieve a sterile product.
They had doubts. They said, this is really difficult. But difficult doesn't get you where you need to go.
What Dr. Akers said is that, but it's unclear that it could have been done because there were several steps that would have to be overcome. Aseptic crystallization is hard. That's where O'Neill failed. That's at column 3, 33 to 40 of O'Neill. After that, you have a problem with micronization. Steckel, on which they rely, Steckel actually was developing, that's 97, was developing a new micronization technique because, as you said, trying to micronize, and this is not aseptic. So this is when you can actually get in and manipulate the system. They said micronization of corticosteroids is beset with problems because it's soft and waxy, and that's not aseptic. What we don't have anywhere in the prior art is any evidence of success with any corticosteroid with sterile filtration and aseptic processing. And more than that, we don't have evidence when one of the vendors came to do it 10 years later, they used a whole new system that didn't exist then, very sophisticated computer control equipment that was not available then, in all of these four methods. And this is why we think objective indicia here is so important, is we have no demonstration, we have all this evidence for all the methods of failure, AstraZeneca's failure, the report of failure with moist heat from defendants. In fact, Mr. Cozy said there is no evidence that anyone failed. Their own chief scientist, McCaffer, testified that three different companies, this is at A4955-56, came to him and said they had failed to make a sterile budesonide suspension, so they believed it to be impossible. That's McCaffer's own testimony at 4955-56. We have real-world evidence with budesonide, not, you know, O'Neill might have succeeded with dexamethasone, but with budesonide, as the McCaffer patent reports, they failed because of degradation. Irradiation failed. Budesonide is hard. We have real-world evidence of failure. No, they did no testing. They never carried out O'Neill to show success.
You're way over your time.
I apologize.
If you want to have a final thought.
This is a case where we felt proper evaluation of the objective indicia make it clear that this was an achievement and a non-obviousness, a non-obvious achievement, and the court disregarded all of that real-world evidence.
Thank you. We thank all